Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the British Royal Fanatic Podcast. I'm Hayden, your American friend with a passion for British royal history. Y'all, we tried. A few days ago, I tried recording the very first video podcast, and it did not go over well between issues with my camera setup, the editing software wasn't doing what I needed it to do. It was just not a good situation. The universe ultimately decided that it didn't want this episode to be our very first video episode, but not all is lost. I'm still in the process of getting better editing software. The YouTube page will be set up by the time the next episode comes out, and actually this audio will be up there on YouTube, so not all is lost. We're still progressing as we said we are. I'm still going to meet that promise to y'all that we are going to start having video content, but the good Lord had better plans for this episode. It was not supposed to happen as a video episode, but our next episode, the one at the end of July, continuing the series that we're starting today, that will be a video episode, so not all is lost. Get ready for that one. But before we get into today's episode, please take a moment and head over to the official podcast blog. That is BritishRoyalFanaticPodcast.wordpress.com. I still notice a lot of you are reading everything, which I appreciate, but not a lot of you are actually subscribing or following to it, setting up the email list, whichever avenue you decide you want to do. There's still more of you just watching the content and reading it instead of actually following it and subscribing to it. So please take a moment. It doesn't take long. If you could go ahead and do that, I would greatly appreciate it. I recently went on a little trip to St. Louis, and in the town neighboring St. Louis, St. Charles, they have this cute little British shop, and I got some wonderful things, especially something to help me celebrate the Platinum Jubilee that I'm excited to share with all of you. That's going to be on the blog, so don't miss it. Please head over and subscribe or follow the blog, whichever fits your fancy. But on to today's episode. One thing that we have always done here at the podcast is we've reviewed royal media. We've taken time, broken down some film, we've looked at interviews, we're beginning to look at television shows, documentaries are going to be down the line, but one of the things that I've always really enjoyed doing on the show, and all of you have seemed to like it as well, is reviewing royal media, digesting it, trying to figure out the truth, you know, using my background in music and theater to really help digest it, to try to better understand it. Well, today we are going to begin tackling the gargantuan show that is The Crown. The Crown came into the world in 2016, has completely turned the head on royal documentaries, even though the show doesn't try to be one, but royal content in general. It's completely twisted everything on its head and opened up this completely new area that really hadn't been done before, or at least to this large of scale. The show has gotten so close to the sun that even the royal family tried to have a disclaimer put out on the most recent season. Season 5 is going to be coming out in November, so to get ready for Season 5, not only are we going to be looking at The Crown, but we're going to begin a larger series of other royal film, other royal television, and just take some time really reviewing royal media and bridging the gap between these fictitious depictions of things and actual history, and try to figure out the middle ground here. How true to life is this? So buckle in. Without further ado, we're going to look at The Crown season by season, and this episode we are starting with season one. Season one of The Crown, of course, as I said, entered the lexicon in 2016, in November of 2016, and it completely ignited a new generation of royal family enthusiasts, those that really started to turn their heads and actually look into the annals of history and try to, you know, again, it sparked this whole new generation of fascination, both with its history, its scandals, of course, big members of the royal family like Princess Margaret, Queen Mary, Princess Diana. They got even more people curious about them. The show has won countless awards, and it has highlighted a lot of the more painful parts of royal history that we're not going to skew away from in our review of it. The show has gone on record saying that it is not journalism, and it's not trying to report on fact. It is Peter Morgan's interpretation of this and the history that, you know, the show takes place around and in. So that's one thing that's really unique about the show, is it's actively informing that this is not the truth, this is a depiction of it, it's a certain avenue of it, and most people understand it, but with the most recent season, season four, the show kind of hit a few nerves, and the royal family actually tried to intervene, but they were unsuccessful. Of course, this show is the love child of Peter Morgan. If you have seen the 2006 film The Queen, that is another one of his works that is truly wonderful and truly marvelous. But season one of The Crown. On IMDb, season one has an overall score of 8.5 out of 10. It has a Rotten Tomatoes score of 88% on their tomato meter, 95% audience rating, and cites that the average critic score is 77%. This season alone has won countless awards for costuming, visual and special effects, casting, cinematography, editing, best period drama, best and outstanding drama, and a whole smorgasbord of individual awards actually won by Claire Foy and John Lithgow, and other nominations for Vanessa Kirby, Jared Harris, Matt Smith, and many more. There's, in fact, a whole Wikipedia page dedicated to the awards that The Crown has been nominated for and the awards that they have actually won. And this show has been nominated for enough awards that even I didn't know some of them. There were some award categories and just awards in general that I had no idea existed. So it's really interesting to see truly how far this show reaches when it comes to award season. So, already a theme in progress, this is a fictitious retelling of history. What is The Crown? The Crown centers around Queen Elizabeth from just before her reign started, when she was just Princess Elizabeth, just the Duchess of Edinburgh, not sure when she was going to actually take the throne, to as close to modern history as we can get. Now, the show is not going to actually get to modern day. It's going to stop at, you know, the early 2000s. They did have a casting call out for Catherine Middleton. So, you know, we'll see truly where the show starts, truly where the show ends. But that is the sort of blanket term of the show. It follows the reign of Queen Elizabeth II. It follows what she's done, some big historical events, but the big thing that the show does is it is these personal family moments. It is this fictitious interpretation of, you know, what happened behind closed doors, what truly happened at this prime minister meeting, what happened over here, what happened over there, and sort of taking a stance with certain things that in some cases doesn't depict the royal family in the most positive light. But each season roughly covers about a decade, give or take. Season one, the season starts in 1947 with her wedding to Prince Philip, and it ends roughly, give or take, around 1955. The goal this season specifically is to focus on the change from young, naive princess, housewife, mother of two, to the queen. It is a lot of this personal struggle, this personal balance, trying to get settled into her marriage and some of the issues that begin to form, dealing with, you know, now she's head of the family, making some of these decisions. She's now, you know, the government's in her name. She has, you know, a lot of learning that she has to do, and this first season really captures just that learning process where she begins to come into her own by the end of the season, but there's a lot of really difficult decisions that need to be made. Now, our core cast members of the show, we have Queen Elizabeth II, is played by Claire Foy, Prince Philip, well, at the time he was just Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh, he had yet to get that princedom, which is played by Matt Smith. Princess Margaret is played by Vanessa Kirby. King George VI is played by Jared Harris. The Queen Mother is played by Victoria Hamilton. Queen Mary is played by Dame Eileen Atkins. And Prime Minister Winston Churchill is played by John Lithgow. Now, John Lithgow is the only, I believe he's the only American to be playing a British character in the show. Now, this season, it was filmed in conjunction with season 2, so this same core cast will, of course, be in season 2. We already know this, but they filmed them back-to-back, which is interesting. So this main core cast, aside from those that die off or just disappear because they're not relevant to history anymore, would do show up in the next season, which goes into the mid-1960s. Now, this season in particular was 100% written by Peter Morgan. There was a rotation of directors. They rotated between 3 different directors for the show. If you can hear that purring, it is our lovely mascot, Prince Margaret. He's been really rambunctious as I've been trying to record, but I'm talking about the crown, little one. Do you have anything to say? There we go. Such a wonderful mouthful. But I'm going to get back to the episode now, okay? So back to what I was saying. The season was 100% written by Peter Morgan, and in turn, there was just a rotation of directors that would direct certain episodes, especially if they were more personal or dealing with a larger bit of history. They, you know, had a huge set. There are a lot of extraneous factors as to why there was a rotation of directors. Now, into some of the behind-the-scenes stuff, which I really, really like, before getting into some larger opinions about the show, is they, of course, could not use real royal residences for the show, because that's just simply, they just can't. Government wouldn't allow it, the royal family wouldn't allow it, so they actually used a lot of real historic homes owned by aristocrats or peers in place of these royal residences, or they built things on the soundstage. One thing to note is that the bedroom area of Buckingham Palace, so where the Queen's bedroom is, where Philip's bedroom is, where their like dressing room area, the like lounge type area that they're in, but those, while all on a soundstage, are actually based on the real blueprints of Buckingham Palace and what they would at least be largely laid out as in real life. So that's something that's really interesting that the set team did, that's of course carried around through each season. So while the private areas of Buckingham Palace, the bedrooms, the sitting rooms, all that, are built on a soundstage, they are based on the real layout in the palace, which is something fun to keep in mind. But the real locations that they used in the show are, of course, our tried and true Lancaster House. Lancaster House made an appearance, of course, in this show, and it's really interesting to see how Lancaster House is used in place of Buckingham Palace, but much more of Lancaster House was used this go-around in the show for Buckingham Palace. In fact, the only area that isn't a soundstage or Lancaster House is the sitting room that the Queen uses for her meetings with the Prime Minister. That's at actually a private home, but I couldn't figure out where that was. There was a blog I found years ago that said what it was. I couldn't find it for my research for this episode. But Lancaster House, of course, stands in for Buckingham Palace. Lye Cathedral, which, in addition to a soundstage, was the stand-in for Westminster Abbey that was used both for the coronation and for the wedding. London's Southwark Cathedral was a stand-in for St. George's Chapel. Greenwich Naval College was used for the courtyard and like the front entrance area of Buckingham Palace. That has since changed. That is now being used. That is now done with a soundstage. Goldsmith Hall was used as the room for the operation hall for King George VI when he had his lung taken out. Beaver Castle and Burley Hall were stand-ins for Windsor Castle, and High Cannon's House was used for Clarence House. And everything else was shot on a soundstage, or again, other homes were used that IMDb, Rotten Tomatoes, and other blogs just either didn't pick up on, or they've been buried by the Google algorithm that I couldn't 100% find. But those are some of the big notable locations that were used for the show that actually still stand. They still appear in the show. So now, time to get into the minutiae of the show, and things I really love discussing about The Crown is the show takes a lot of liberties, and they do so very deliberately, and they do so very intentionally. Of course, it'd be incredibly boring if it was just a retelling of history. That is, you know, that's not what we're here. We're here for drama. We're here for, you know, the show to take a little bit of, you know, pull some punches, take a stance, and that's what the show does. And the big thing that I've already said before is that the show tries to explain what happens behind closed doors, what goes on in these, you know, private prime minister meetings. All we know is the record that they happen. There's no script. They're not recorded. These private meetings, these private family moments, these intimate, you know, settings where the public isn't privy to. The public doesn't know these things. It's, you know, how they're functioning in their day-to-day lives. Or behind the scenes of these really big historical moments to try to, again, color in what might have happened here. You know, what could have possibly happened. And so one of the things that I like to think about is that they're trying to give these characters, these, you know, characters based off real people, they're giving them a character arc. They have to have some form of change or progression. They have to have an arc. We have to also inform character traits and character decisions of these real life characters very quickly. And of course, they're often exaggerated. There's some people that know history, like me, like some of all of you listening in, but there are those that don't necessarily know history, that they have to inform the greater character. And so certain liberties are taken to inform the larger character traits that the show is picking to exaggerate, picking to highlight. And so certain liberties are taken. Now, one thing that the show does not change is the historical events that happen in real time. Those we cannot change. But where the show changes are the little details. My friend Liz from college put The Crown in this wonderful analogy that it's to taking the coloring book of history and just picking different crayons to color within the lines with. Or sometimes they don't color in the lines at all, but, you know, the general outline stays the same, but the finer details are truly what's different about the show. Now, there are notable real events that do happen that the show folds in to its own storytelling. What are just some of the real events that happened in season one? Well, we have right out of the gate, Prince Philip giving up his, you know, Greece and Denmark citizenship. He gives up his HRH and Prince title of Greece and Denmark. He completely renounces all of that, his connections to the Greece and Denmark royal family. He, in turn, you know, becomes a citizen of the United Kingdom. While he gets his own HRH, he doesn't outright get a princedom, and he in turn upon his marriage gets his dukedom, his earldom, and his barondom. And then at that point the next day he becomes His Royal Highness the Duke of Edinburgh. He is not a prince again just yet. Of course, the wedding of at that point Lieutenant Philip Mountbatten and then Her Royal Highness Princess Elizabeth. King George VI having his lung surgery and his eventual failing health. Of course, the death of Queen Mary, the death of King George VI, the big tour that Philip and Elizabeth go on behalf of the king, Princess Margaret and her relationship with Group Captain Peter Townsend, the great fog that happened, Winston Churchill's health issues and, you know, what he chose to share, what he chose to hide, the issues over the house name, where they were going to live, the coronation, and of course, the relationship with His Royal Highness the Duke of Windsor, his wife, the Duchess, Wallis Simpson, and still the animosity felt towards the abdication. So those are the big pillar moments of the show, big moments in history that they do not change, that they include anyway. Now we're going to get into some things that the show changes, where it alters from history that some things aren't necessarily that big of a deal, but some things are a big of a deal that the show paints the royals in a slightly different light, but they do it to inform the larger character. The first one we're going to talk about is Prince Philip and the coronation. In the show, Prince Philip is seen not only the one who brought in the cameras, tried to modernize it, did the best that he could, but he's seen having this really big argument with Queen Elizabeth about, you know, his role in the coronation and the idea of him bowing, where it seems to them, you know, really at a standstill that, you know, the queen's taking over duty, the Prince Philip is really headstrong and set in this, you know, I shouldn't have to. And they have this big, you know, argument in Westminster Abbey. In reality, that didn't happen. That argument did not happen. And in fact, when you look objectively, when you watch documentaries about the coronation, that's one thing that he knew he couldn't change. And he was completely actually on board for. He grew up, you know, he grew up royalty. He grew up in royal circles. He did spend time over with the British royal family. His family, of course, has connections to it. So his family and his upbringing, he is aware that this is something that needs to happen. He wouldn't have argued, and in fact, he didn't. There are a lot of sources in these documentaries, in my research, that have all corroborated the same story. Yes, he was headstrong. Yes, he was, you know, quite the character. But there are some things with tradition that he knew to not mess with that he had to do as consort to the queen. And he wouldn't have argued. He knew that, yep, this is my role. This is what I'm to do. So that's the first thing that they do. Take a little bit of artistic liberty there. But they're again informing that Prince Philip is this, you know, headstrong, set in, this is what I want to do. The next one that I actually have a little bit of a problem with is the whole handling of Prince Margaret and Group Captain Peter Townsend. Of course, this storyline did exist. Princess Margaret did fall in love with the group captain. They did have an affair. His wife did end up leaving him. And they tried really hard to make it work. The group captain was sent over to Brussels in hope that, you know, the weight would, you know, throw them off the scent. They really wouldn't want to do it. But ultimately, they still really loved each other. He's a divorcee. She's a member of the royal family. And the threat was real that she would have to give up everything in order to love him. And ultimately, the queen comes in and says, you know, you can't do this. And it further, you know, drives a wedge between the sisters. And it was the queen who told her no. When in reality, things were different. In reading 99 Glimpses of Princess Margaret and Lady in Waiting, My Life in the Shadow of the Crown by Lady Glenconner, she really helps, Lady Glenconner specifically, really helps color in how this story ends. And that they actually really tried to make it work. When also you look objectively at history, there's record that, you know, the Queen and the Privy Council were actually trying to come up with ways for Margaret to keep her position, to keep her place within the line of succession, her money from the privy purse, to keep her HRH and her princess title, and, you know, keep everything and still marry him. But in reality, it was actually Margaret and Group Captain Peter Townsend. They came to an agreement. Whoever had more say will never fully know, because, you know, they're both since gone. But they ended up making the decision for them. Though the queen was actually still advocating for Margaret. But history is different. The show took a stance of, you know, dividing the sisters, which the show's largely doing, is that, you know, the queen has this dead set, you know, as a sister I approve, but as the queen I can't, you know, this idea of duty, this whole perspective of duty and duty to the crown, and, you know, Margaret being this rebel, basically the polar opposite of her sister, that's what the show's trying to inform, and they're choosing to alter history this way to help tell that story, where it could be actually slightly more powerful, in my opinion, if they did follow through with how history truly was, where the queen is, you know, trying really hard to get the Margaret what she wants, but ultimately Margaret decides, no, enough time has passed, we've changed too much, yes, we still love each other, but that spark, that certain something just isn't there anymore. And, you know, they address it. They actually see each other quite a few times after they decide to not fully marry. And, you know, he goes back to Brussels. He marries who he eventually marries. Margaret eventually marries who she marries. And history continues as, you know, as such. But the show could have done that to, you know, take a unique stance that, you know, Margaret, while being this polar opposite of the queen, still actually had a sense of duty within herself. And there are little bits of the wedding they actually chose to leave out. Of course, there's where the tiara broke. Somebody forgot the queen's pearl necklace at one point. There were missing bridal bouquets. There were certain chaotic things that did happen that the show just left out, because at that point, those aren't necessary for the storytelling. But they did leave out some of the more chaotic things at the wedding. Another thing that is really unique that the show adds that was never there was the letter from Queen Mary to the young Queen Elizabeth II. The show sees where when she lands in London after the king has died and she gets a letter from the Queen saying, you know, there will be two Elizabeths that you'll constantly be dealing with. Elizabeth Alexander Mary, you know, Elizabeth Mountbatten, and Elizabeth Regina, the Queen. They're going to be a constant battle, but the crown must always win. You can't, you need to separate dalliances, indulgences. You need to be able to separate. It's duty and crown before all. And in reality, this letter never happened. There was never a letter like this. There's no record of a letter like this happening. This is truly the show adding and fabricating things. But what is the show doing to us, the viewer? It's painting, you know, that the queen is now at a crossroads, where she's now the queen of the United Kingdom and the Commonwealth, but she's also still this very young wife, this very young mother. She's now the head of the family, and it's visual storytelling of the crossroads that she's at. And in reality, that that letter never happened, but it's, you know, the conversation that they have, you know, it does slightly boost the ego of the British monarchy in some ways, but it underlines that, you know, duty before all. And again, it's a way for us to further understand the crossroads that she's at. The show, again, adds more things. Very first episode, we see the king coughing up blood into the toilet. It's 1947. In reality, he was not that sick at that point. He was never that sick to where he was coughing up blood. He wasn't coughing up blood already. That they, you know, they accelerate history a little bit. And why are they doing this? Again, we have to put our context hats on. There are some people that don't know history that the king got sick. The king, you know, was in failing health. He was smoking a lot, which ultimately led to cancer. And one of the things when reading the big objective biography by Sally Bettle Smith, by reading Little Princesses, by their former nanny, Crawfee, in reading, you know, My Life in the Shadow of the Crown, one of the things that's always highlighted is after World War II, the king never looks the same. He's thinner, he's gaunt, he looks tired all the time. And, you know, we're entering the show already in post-World War II Britain, but it's, you know, very only 2 years post-World War Britain, World War II Britain. And, you know, the show is trying to inform, okay, the king's sick, the king's, you know, and then we're moving on. It's to inform, you know, people that don't necessarily know history that, you know, the king's not necessarily in the best of health at this time. Winston Churchill never had an assistant named Venetia Scott. She never existed. This is solely here to give the character Winston Churchill a character arc. London already had poor air quality at the time of the Great Smog, and in fact, when the smog did appear, they wouldn't have reacted so extremely. And in fact, they wouldn't have reacted until weeks later. And at that point, people were really getting sick and dying. So again, the show took artistic liberty with the episode about the smog. But it, again, it's not necessarily about the smog per se. It's, you know, putting Prime Minister and Queen at odds and showing that, you know, the Queen is developing and Winston Churchill isn't doing his job as Prime Minister. That's what that episode is truly meant to inform. In this first season, the Queen and Winston Churchill are sort of put at odds against each other, and they sort of provide each other's character arc, where the Queen is becoming stronger into her own. She's becoming more confident, and she's taking a stance with her Prime Ministers. Winston Churchill's getting old, he can't do his job anymore, he's, you know, lying behind her back. They're providing each other with their own character arc, but in reality, they actually had a really good rapport, and there's many times where the Queen has said that her favorite Prime Minister was Winston Churchill. So the show, again, is taking liberties here to provide character arcs for the show. A show without a character arc would be incredibly boring, so that's what the show's doing. The show does insinuate that the Queen had a crush on Lord Porchester, aka Porchy, who is eventually would then become the Earl of Carnarvon. But in reality, she truly only had sights for Prince Philip. She tried to go on, you know, these little dates and dances, you know, just to be social. But truly, in reality, Prince Philip was the only one for her, and the only one she had sights on. So there's no substantial evidence to support that she had a crush on anybody else. You know, if she had, you know, fancied someone else, it would have been a very, very quick thing, very fleeting fancy, because again, her heart was only in one place and it was for Philip, which is, you know, kind of romantic. But what the show's doing with this storyline is highlighting, you know, some of the issues that the young marriage had. They're at ends with one another. Philip's not around. He's maybe having an affair. You know, we don't know for sure, but she's feeling alone. And so she's leaning into her horse racing. And who's there? Lord Porchester Porchy. So those are some of the larger moments where the show takes a stance and actively changes history. They're, of course, smaller, minute details, but those are the ones that really stood out to me, or to critics, the ones that critics had a really big issue with. Critics had a huge issue with the fact of, you know, the king coughing in 1947, Phoenicia Scott never existed, Philip would have bowed and he actually had no issue with it. There really wasn't a lot of talk amongst critics about the Princess Margaret storyline, and in fact that one was the one of the ones that was accepted as biblical truth. What if you look objectively at history, you'll know that it's different. Where does this season excel? The costumes, the jewels, those truly, you know, chef's kiss are fantastic. The royal jewels are replicated so beautifully. Even if they don't look 100% accurate, they're easily, you can 100% identify what these jewels are. The costumes are great, both being period accurate, but also unique to the character, where Princess Margaret has one style of wardrobe, the queen has a different. They're very visually different to inform, you know, through sartorial messaging, they're different. The jewels, it's just, I cannot praise this season enough for the costumes, the jewels. It's one of my favorite parts of the show, trying to pick out what jewels they're using in certain scenes. And this one is truly wonderful in terms of the jewel replication. It's, you know, chef's kiss, fantastic. The gown replications are really good. We're going to get into one that's truly magnificent in a moment. Another thing where the series truly excels, this season specifically, is the relationships between the characters and the true work that the actors did. It's, again, they got nominated and won awards for a reason. It's the acting when there's, you know, no talking, when it's, you know, the facial expressions and these private moments, you know, when Margaret's having a breakdown, or, you know, the scene that's standing out to me immediately when recording is when Prince Philip learns that the king's dead and the private secretary has just informed him. He knows Princess Elizabeth, now queen, is all excited, you know, oh, who's here? And then that moment across the lawn where, you know, they're not saying a word, but their faces say everything. And truly these young relationships where, you know, emotions are really heightened, you know, the crossroads that the queen's put at as mother, person, wife, but also queen, head of the family. It's, the acting is truly stellar, and they're all the nominations and everything, you know, they 100% deserve. The show's like a masterclass in, you know, body acting, you know, facial acting, you know, how things, scenes can be more powerful when there's actually no words spoken, and it's just truly how you embody the character, you know. I tip my hat to all of you. The casting excels. They took some risks. I wouldn't have thought Jonathan Lithgow playing, you know, Winston Churchill would be something I would see in my lifetime. But it works. It works. It, you know, it paid off. And, you know, it was a unique take. But, you know, I personally think it was wonderful. He brought something different to the table. You know, in interviews, he even, you know, didn't think he would get it, but he did. And, you know, he tried really hard. You know, of course, everybody loves Gary Oldman as Winston Churchill, but this, again, this was a different interpretation of Winston Churchill. And the interiors of the show, both made for a soundstage and the real ones that they used, again, could not be better. And it really, again, helps set the scene for what, you know, it further makes the show believable. It further grounds the show, being in these really antique, grand interiors. You know, the muted color palettes, you know, the huge grandiosity of Buckingham Palace of... Hi, can you not do that? Hi, can you not do that? Can you not do that? Of, you know, these grand interiors, these grand spaces, it helps, again, make the show feel real, makes the show feel believable, makes the show feel grounded. And that is something that is, again, really unique to the show, that they used so many real interiors and blurred the line with the soundstage interiors. You know, if you watch, there's an Architecture Digest where they break down, you know, how you can tell if it's a soundstage or if it's a real interior. And, you know, even still with that knowledge, I still sometimes can't even figure out which is the real and which is the soundstage. So good on them for really, you know, doing their work there. Some fun facts about the season to talk about. Princess Margaret and the Queen in reality were almost the same height. Princess Margaret was actually a little shorter, maybe like 1 or 2 inches shorter. But the actresses, Vanessa Kirby and Claire Foy, are nowhere close to the same height. Vanessa Kirby is much taller than Claire Foy. So what they did is that any scene where they were together, Vanessa Kirby's in flats and the Queen, Claire Foy, is in heels to try to make their heights closer. And that's one of the things that Lady Glenn Connor was really critical about, the, you know, the role of Princess Margaret, of Vanessa Kirby, is that, you know, seeing this really tall Princess Margaret, you know, kind of messes with my brain a little bit. You know, she was never that tall. Additionally, in terms of height, Jonathan Lithgow, 6'4". John Lithgow is really tall. Winston Churchill was about my height, 5'7", 5'8". And because of this, they actually had to spew some of the lines of 10 Downing Street, especially that front door, in order to, you know, try to get the, you know, sight lines right, try to keep things, you know, somewhat close to, you know, perspective. But Jonathan Lithgow is very tall. Winston Churchill was not. This show is, of course, one of Netflix's most expensive to create, and I think it still holds the record for being the most expensive show Netflix has made. The coronation dress worn by Claire Foy is actually a replica that was originally commissioned by Harrods for a celebratory window display for the Queen's Jubilee in 2012. The dress was made and is still owned by Angels Costumes, which many of the costumes for the show came from. They happened to have it. It was on a mannequin. It's mannequin size, and it fit Claire Foy perfectly. So they were able to use this almost, you know, to a T replica. Certain embroidery techniques were different. Instead of being sewn on, they were iron-ons. But, you know, that coronation dress, you know, was a complete find that was used for the Queen's Jubilee for a display. Claire Foy is, of course, 4 years older than Vanessa Kirby in real life, which is actually the same age difference between the Queen and Princess Margaret. So that's just, again, something a little fun. This next fact is something that's truly interesting, and if you're a fan of British programming and British British drama such as me, you recognize this character actor. Alex Jennings plays the Duke of Windsor, and he previously starred as Prince Charles in the 2006 film The Queen, which was, of course, directed by Peter Morgan, which, of course, was written by Peter Morgan. Jennings also played King George III in Liberty, the American Revolution from 1997, and King Leopold I of Belgium in the series Victoria in 2016. So he's played a lot of royals, especially, you know, playing Prince Charles, George III, and now the Duke of Windsor, you know, the abdicated Edward VIII. And I think in likeness, you know, as he's gotten older, when you look at him and the Duke of Windsor from that exact same time period, it is a very good likeness. That was a very, very good casting choice. And the last fun fact of the show, the last fun fact of this season, is that this is the only season that the real Queen, the real Her Majesty the Queen, has watched all the way through. She watched season 2 to a point, but then she stopped after they took too many liberties and she didn't agree with it. But this is the only season the Queen has watched through and through. Other royals, such as Princess Eugenie, other royals, notably Her Royal Highness Princess Eugenie and Her Royal Highness the Countess of Wessex, actually still watch the show. But the Queen has watched this season, and she said that she really appreciated it and, you know, understood what the show was doing. So now on to my thoughts. We've talked a lot about what the show got right, what the show got wrong, fun facts about the season specifically, locations that they used, strengths overall of the show, casting, the purpose of the show, what it's doing, other little fun facts. But now what do I think of the show? I love this season. This season is actually one of my favorites. I've watched this season probably the most, and it has become comfort television for me. I think that this season is the one that the Royals feel less threatened by, because it's so far removed from history, and it doesn't really touch on a lot of controversial topics yet. It doesn't really do much to paint the Royals in a bad light yet. The Margaret thing, you know, they took liberties there, which I'm still a little bit perturbed by, because they could have done something different with the character of Margaret in doing so. But this season, I feel the Royals feel the less threatened by. Some things that I wish they would have changed is just the Margaret thing. I really wouldn't change much about the season because they did so much so beautifully. I do wish that they, you know, maybe did a little bit more into the abdication, just again highlighting truly how much that really damaged the family. Again, everybody who's watched the King's Speech knows how truly damaging the abdication was. If you've done your homework, you truly know how much this truly hurt the family. And the show does do things at times to highlight, but that's just me being picky in this season, because it would have set up season two a little bit better, but we're going to get to that in a minute. But this show is flawless. I love everything about it. This is, it's become comfort television for me. I cannot wait for season five. This season and season four are tied for my favorite seasons. And I'll go into why when we get to the season, but this one, why is this one my favorite? The costumes are fantastic. The settings are great. The writing is very compelling. The acting and the direction the actors got is really good. It's a truly well-made, it's truly a well-crafted piece of art in some regards. They got so much right, and what they do choose to change still feels believable. These characters feel believable, the characters feel grounded, the characters, even the choices that alter from the path of history, still feel grounded in the character, which is why so many people accept the show as biblical truth. The decisions that are different still feel believable. But there we have it, a fun wrap-up of season one, my favorite season of The Crown. Truly fantastic, you know, hats off to you, Peter Morgan. You did such a great job, and I can't wait for season five, but tune in 2 weeks, where we will delve into season two, into more conflict and sort of the royal soap opera that begins to form that we now know of today. My sources for today's podcast are IMDb, Rotten Tomatoes, Wikipedia, Suggest.com, Reader's Digest, FindThatLocation.com, RadioTimes.com, BT.com, and Architecture's Digest. If you made it this far, thank you for stopping by the podcast today. I really appreciate it. If you would like to suggest topics for future episodes, let me know how I'm doing, or just, would like to write into the show, you can drop a line over at the email, BritishRoyalFanPod@gmail.com. There's our official blog, BritishRoyalFanaticPodcast.wordpress.com. There's our Twitter, @fanatic_royal. There's our Facebook page, The British Royal Fanatic Podcast. All of our socials, hit me up over there. Things are growing, things are expanding. Join the family, you're more than welcome. If you would like to donate to the show, you can do so with a one-time PayPal donation linked on the Twitter page. Any donations would be greatly appreciated. It can help make this content the best it very can be. Head on over to wherever you're listening to rate, review, subscribe, and share. The more you do, the more people can see the show, the bigger the family can get, and the more opportunities we can have. I'd like to have more guests on the show. Have a great rest of your week, everyone. Stay safe and stay healthy out there, and I will see you in the next one.